Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome everybody to another Royal Automobile Club talk show in association with Motorsport Magazine. Now, this is a very, very special talk show we have today. Gordon Murray, thank you very much for joining us. We also have Gordon Cruikshank from Motorsport Magazine. He's our editor at large. Is that right, Gordon?
That's correct.
Yeah, editor at large. There we go. And Simon Aaron, thank you, Simon, for joining us today. Simon
Aaron
is our features editor at Motorsport Magazine. Now, Gordon, I tried to write an introduction and I knew it had to be very brief. I'm afraid I gave up because I don't think there is a way of summarising your career. Now, recently, though, we had an exhibition, 50 years of Gordon Murray design. I wonder if we can start this talk show by describing this exhibition, what it meant to you, and then we'll move on to a little bit of your current activity at the moment. So let's start with the exhibition. Tell us why you did it.
Well, it was for several reasons, actually, but of course the underlying reason was it's 50 years since I designed and built my own car, my first car. That was in Southern Africa, in Durban, where I grew up. And I came from a motor racing family. My dad was a motor mechanic, and ever since I was 6 years old, I wanted to go racing. And ultimately, the only way I could go racing and afford to go racing was to design my own car and develop my own engine, which I did when I was 19, 20. And then I raced the car in 67 and 68 in South Africa before I came over to the UK. So it's 50 years. I don't know where the 50 years has gone, but it's 50 years. So I thought that deserved celebrating. But coincidentally with that, it was 10 years of our current business, Gordon Murray Design.
Yeah.
And we had several announcements to make as well. So the 2017, we had this wonderful coincidence of 25 years of the McLaren F1, 10 years of the business, 50 years of my car design.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a pretty good excuse.
Good stuff. We have a number of questions from our readers, which will, I think, they will probably dominate this talk show. We've had more questions than we've had, I think, for any talk show in recent times. But I think if you could describe, many of our readers have said, can you explain the structure and the kind of the profile of Gordon Murray Design at the moment, what it means, and how the various products that our readers, I think, will know about, iStream and Superlight, how they spin out of the central business?
Yeah, sure. I think we have to describe what iStream is and the core business at the moment. I think we have to really take a step back, because I've always been interested in structural composites.
Yeah.
Aerodynamics and structural composites, my two sort of favorite subjects in racing. And way back in the 70s with Brabham, we had the first composite rear wing, which was half the weight of an aluminium wing. And then it went on through the years. First carbon brakes in 76 on the Brabham Alpha. The first carbon in a monocoque in 79 with the BD48. And the first carbon road car with the F1. First carbon clutch with the F1. But it was probably late 1990s. I was still at McLaren.
Yeah.
And for a long time, I've been pondering about the use of structural composites, but in high volume cars.
Okay.
And bringing it down to a level where the likes of you and I could benefit from what racing had brought to us, if you like. And there were three major issues. There was material cost, process time, and attaching point loads to honeycomb panels. And I had to find a way of solving those three problems. And iStream does solve those three problems.
Yeah.
So Gordon Murray Design was set up 10 years ago to develop that technology and industrialize it. And our core business model is we license that technology to as many people as we can all around the world for fundamentally high volume motor cars.
Yeah.
TVR is probably the exception rather than the rule with just a couple of thousand cars a year. The technology itself is rarely Formula One technology for the everyday motorist. It uses honeycomb panels, mm-hmm. which are robot bonded into a very simple lightweight frame.
Yeah.
And we have different versions of that. The iStream we developed initially was glass fiber panels with a recycled paper honeycomb between the two panels over a steel frame. Then we introduced iStream Carbon, which changed the glass to carbon fiber, and that's currently being used by Yamaha prototypes and TVR prototype.
Yeah.
And now the latest one, which we announced at the event, was iStream Superlight, which uses aluminium and recycled carbon.
Yeah.
And it's pretty affordable and is going to produce a body in white that's about 50% reduction in stamp metal.
Okay, we're going to come back to Superlight, I promise. Gordon, tell me about the exhibition.
I was deeply impressed. I knew there was a wide spread of things to be seen, but the fact that there were 40 cars there, I don't know how you assembled all them, including all the rarities from the Brabham Alphas, the fan car, and even your original car, which I think you had to reconstruct.
That's right, yeah.
Can I ask about your original car? When you reconstructed it, did you resist the temptation to make it better?
Well, funnily enough, it's a little bit of a hybrid because I had two versions in 67. When I first raced the car and hill climbed the car, circuit racing and hill climbing, I did well, but I wasn't happy with the motor car and I lowered it for the second year, lightened it and lowered it. And for 68, it looked quite different, although it was it was the same chassis, it was cut down, if you like, and a more lay down driving position in 68. And then I had a new chassis on board for 69, but that's when I decided to leave for the UK. So what we built was actually the 68 car with a couple of the 69 mods, but it's pretty accurate.
Yeah.
I kept all the drawings, and we had plenty of photographs. The only thing that was wrong with it is that my prototype boys did a much better job. I said to them, when you finish it, you need to kick it around the workshop a bit because it looks too good.
Yeah.
If you hadn't left for the UK when you did, do you think the original car would have grown a fan on the back at some point?
I said I've always been fascinated with aerodynamics, which is why I lowered the car.
Right.
I reduced the frontal area by about 25% between 67 and 68 and went 7 miles an hour quicker on the straight.
But talking of keeping the records and the photos, you just keep everything, don't you?
I do.
I'm told that your personal archive is four times the size of the motorsport office.
Yes. Well, for the warm-up for this, a good example is for the warm-up for this event, we decided to have a sort of a, as you know, a holding area, and we had my own classic cars in that area. And one of our brand team, Jenna, said to me, why don't we have some of your T-shirts up? How many have you got? And I said, I don't know. I've been collecting ever since I've been traveling, really. And I said, probably 150, 200. And she said, do you mind if we come sort them out for the event? And I said, not at all. Evidently, I've got 980. So we had 200 of those up at the event.
Tell me what all of the cars that were on display, tell me what they all have in common. I think I know, but I think our readers will and our listeners would like to know.
The answer to that, the clue is in the name of the event. One formula, if you haven't clocked it, is lightweight. So that's why, starting with a classic car collection and running through to the main exhibition, when you had the board with the description of the car, the weight was always in red.
Yeah.
And that's been my mantra. Chapman was my hero when I was growing up as a teenager in South Africa. And, you know, I feel I'm quite similar the way I approach things to Chapman.
Can I say that there was another theme running through that exhibition? They all look good. There's not an ugly car in the whole lot.
Yeah, well,
the mini bug was functional, shall we say.
Well, even that, you know, it's square because I couldn't make curved panels in those days because it's a stressed aluminium skin.
But then Ox is all square and that's well proportioned. It's quite handsome.
That's right, yeah. I think I'm highly unusual as an engineer. Normally, engineers can't even draw stick men. You know, they're not artistic at all. It doesn't go with the territory. But I actually started in art when I was 11. I went to art school as an extra activity outside normal school. And I was doing art at prep school. And I had a teacher at prep school. And I was at a government school with over 1,000 pupils. I had a teacher unbelievably write to my folks and say, this guy fills his notebooks with racing car suspension and electric guitars and aeroplanes. And I don't think he should be in art. So when I went to high school, I only did a month of art and then I switched to technical drawing. Thank goodness, because I would have made a pretty lousy artist, I think.
Yes.
So I think I have that enough artistic side in me. So when I draw a car, I love styling cars. I've styled all my cars. I've led the styling team on all my cars, apart from the SLR, which was done by Mercedes or Daimler Chrysler in those days. And I think that's why the cars are probably slightly better proportioned than the other cars at the time.
Well, it showed.
Let's. You mentioned Colin Chapman being your hero. How did you get your information as a kid growing up in the 60s about racing? How did you know about these guys?
Well, it was through magazines.
Yeah.
In those days.
Such as that.
Only magazines. But they used to come C-mail.
Right.
So you would get them 4 to 5 weeks after they were released in the UK. But it didn't really matter because South Africa was so isolated anyway. Mm. Not just geographically and politically, but from the point of view of keeping up to date with what was going on in the outside world, it was very colonial. Mm. And so it didn't seem to matter that it was the stuff was 4 or 5 weeks late.
Yeah.
So I used to devour those mags, I mean, cover to cover. Yeah. And that's when I first saw, you know, the Lotus 7, the Lotus Elan, and of course the racing cars.
Yeah.
And then I used to, from my first Grand Prix, I think it was 1959, East London.
Yeah.
And then we used to go up to Kyle Army for the Grand Prix. We used to hitchhike 400 miles.
400 miles
to
Kyle Army.
And before we had a car. And then we used to drive. And we also used to go to the, I think it was called the Sunshine Series, where they brought the latest GT and sports cars out every winter, European winter. So there was always the latest Ferrari prototypes, Porsche 904s, 906s, GTO Ferraris, GT44s. Mm. And in those days, you could mix with the people in the paddock. So, you know, it was a lot of first-hand stuff as well.
So interesting to hear you talk about the aesthetics and the engineering of these cars. Was you drawn to the look of the vehicle to start with, or did you work your way past that and start to dig around underneath the skin? I mean, what was your
that's
true
a, that's a good question. I think the honest answer is it was more about the design of the car rather than what I call styling.
Right.
Having said that, so many of the good cars look good, and the reason why the early Lotuses look good is Chapman was excellent at surrounding himself with good people.
Yeah.
And one of those people was Costin. And Costin had a fantastic feel for aerodynamics and for shape. And if you look at all the early Lotai, a lot of them are Costin cars.
Yeah.
And they look really good. And I think Chapman himself had a pretty good feel from an engineering point of view, but also from an aesthetic point of view. And things like, I mean, a good example is Lotus 25, you know, the first monocoque racing car. Beautiful little thing. You still look at them today, and it's just so beautifully proportioned.
Yeah.
So even though it was probably the design that attracted me and a step forward, it sort of went hand in hand with good-looking cars too. And generally, it was true. If you go right back to the 50s, you know, the cars that made breakthroughs and cars like the Lancia D50, the cars that were different, but they all the proportions were always really, really good.
Yeah. Which we don't see in Formula One today. We see
no, but it's very aero-driven now, isn't it? But I think also in the old days, those cars were usually single person cars, or they were a very small group of people. So if you had somebody like Mauro Fegheri doing the 206 Dino SP, beautiful little car, you know, people would do the body and the chassis and the suspension. And I think that holistic design led to good-looking cars. They were also good mechanically.
Yeah. So what can we expect then of the Superlight? It's the car of the moment, and we've seen a single kind of mysterious sketch, and everybody's looking at this sketch going, has it got an airbox? Is it how big is it? Well, I'm sure you can give us a number of exclusives here.
Teasers are fun, aren't they? Yeah. I think we have to, again, take a little step back. We're not starting a car company. I don't want to start a car company at 71 years old. What we are starting is an automotive business, and there's a subtle difference. It's all on the basis and on the back of iStream Superlight. So while at the moment we're only licensing the technology, I thought what a what a nice step forward it would be to actually come up with a few platforms that so people can actually license the platform. So you cut out of the time scale for the customer all the, you know, the concept design and the going through all that those loops before you actually get to a rolling chassis, if you like. And because the body on iStream is non-structural, one platform could have several different bodies on it. So then I started thinking, okay, well, if we're going to make our own platforms, why don't we make a few limited editions of our own car? And if you want to start with something that grabs people's attention, do a headline car.
Yeah.
And it sort of falls in line with after the F1, you know, 25 years ago. For the last 5 years, I've been thinking I've probably got one more good sports car in me. And what a great opportunity to do it using our new technology and launch the car company with it and relaunch the IGM brand, which is now 50 years old. So again, it was a matter of all the stars aligning, if you like. And that's why we announced the teaser in the car.
Yeah,
I was very impressed that you had the steering wheel from the T1 car, the original car.
Yeah, that's all that remains.
With the IGM logo on it.
Yeah, it was cut. It was badly cut. The IGM logo was badly cut out of vinyl, I think. Fablon or whatever it's called in those days.
That's a bit of dedication to carry that through for 50 years and finally produce the car.
It's wonderful that we've got a brand that, you know, we don't have to invent a new brand. We've got a brand that's already 50 years old.
Yeah. Okay, we are going to jump around all sorts of eras, I'm afraid, due to the questions and probably the way our minds work. But if we go back this time to when you came over to the UK, you had a job offer from Colin Chapman, didn't you? And that,
yes.
But it didn't work out the way you expected.
No, I was, again, you know, you feel rarely isolated when you're 7,000 miles away in the Southern Hemisphere. But I wasn't thinking about racing at all. I thought, you know, even on the back of doing my own engine and car and having some success in racing, I thought there's no way, you know, a 21-year-old or whatever is going to get a job in racing. So I thought Lotus Cars or Lotus Engineering, as it was called then, that would be a good starting point. So I wrote to Colin, got a really nice letter back saying, sounds like we could use somebody, not actually a job offer, we could use somebody like you. Would you write to a chap called Brian Luff in Vehicle Engineering, which was the car business, which I did. And Brian said, when you get over to England, come for an interview. So it wasn't actually, we have a job for you, but it sounded pretty good. And I think the last letter, I honestly can't remember the exact time, but I think the last letter was about 3 months before I left for the UK.
Yeah.
On my second day in the UK, I went up to Hethel and to meet Brian, but he said, haven't you been reading the newspapers? You know, there's a recession. We've just laid off, you know, quite a few people. And look at all those cars out there. They're unsold. And that was the end of that.
How much time did you... I know it didn't quite work out at Lotus, but how much time over the subsequent years did you spend with Colin Chapman? I'd like to get an idea of the conversations that you had when you were sharing a glass of wine.
Well, Colin was understandably aloof. Mm-hmm. He wasn't that sort of guy, actually, but, I mean, he was a very important guy in Formula One. I started travelling at the end of 72, beginning of 73, and I was a kid. You know, I was running, running a Formula One team when I was 26, and which is quite frightening now, looking back. And, I was the new kid on the block, and I think the first year I might have got a nod from Colin, but that was it. I wouldn't dare to go up and start a conversation. Whereas some of the other team owners were far more approachable. I got to know Ken Tyrrell very well quite early on. And drivers, of course, Jackie Stewart and people like that, I got to know. But not Chapman until 1 year later at Watkins Glen when we were first and second on the grid with the BD44.
Yeah.
And first and second in the race, and I think fastest lap and second fastest lap. And after the race, I was walking back to the sort of shed where we worked, and Chapman was approaching me, and he squared up in front of me, put his hand out and shook my hand, and he said, that's the way to do it. And that night, I got a job offer from him through a third party.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if you still had the letter from Chapman.
I have the letter from Chapman.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you know where everything is in this archive then?
Well, it was until... 6 months before the event, just stashed away in the top of one of my barns at home. But the girls have come over and sorted it all now, and it's all properly archived and date order now. So,
good.
And what made you decline the job offer from Chapman?
Good question, because I thought, even at that young age, I thought probably Chapman and I were too alike. I was very, very bolshy in those days and very autocratic. And I knew what I wanted and got my own way, and I was the only designer in the office. I had nobody to argue with, and Bernie gave me a completely free hand. And I looked at Chapman and I thought, he's probably pretty much, from what I've read, pretty much the same. And I could just see a lot of headbanging. I'd already had some stand-up discussions with Ron Toranak at Brabham about suspension geometry and bump steer and Ackerman and stuff like that, stress calculations. And I thought we'd spend most of our time arguing rather than getting on with the job. And that's why I declined, actually.
Did I've read something last night doing some research that when Bernie came in to look at buying Brabham, Ron suggested keep everyone else on the design team apart from yourself, and Bernie did the opposite.
I've never got to the bottom of that. I have had so many people claim, honestly, at least four people have claimed that it was them that said to Bernie, keep Gordon. And I've asked the old boy himself. I said to Bernie, why did you keep me?
Yeah.
And he's never once said it was somebody that said to me. He just said, it's something I did. I got rid of everybody and kept you. Whether somebody, one of the four people that have said it was them, did have a word with them or not, I have no idea. But I don't believe the Ron Toranak story, because Ron and I got on very well. And Ron knew that I was, unless he wanted to try and scupper the ship or something, because I was the one in the office that did nearly all the stress calculations, right, and the aero work. Yeah. And I designed most of the car, you know. Yeah. So I don't think it would have been Ron.
Okay. Let's talk about the Bernie era at Brabham. What did he give you that allowed your creativity to run free? I mean, you mentioned how you still have the mind of, or the kind of personality in many ways of an artist, but often the artist needs the space to be able to work. What did Bernie do to make sure that he could get the best out of you at that time?
But Bernie quite simply gave me a free hand and trust, and that's all you need. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think you have the ability to run the team and design the cars and develop the cars and engineer the cars, that's what you need. You need somebody that trusts you and somebody that doesn't interfere with the design of the cars, which Bernie never did.
Right.
And although we had a very small budget, funnily enough, in the 70s and even the 80s, having a free hand was much more important than a budget.
Okay.
Because it was a period where you could innovate in big steps and make big steps forward. Nowadays, you need the budget because you need to pour massive amount of people and energy into micro, yes, changes,
yeah,
to get a performance gain. In those days, all you needed was a good head on your shoulders and some ideas.
Yeah.
And you could go second a lap quicker.
Yeah. But you also needed immense confidence that what you were doing was right. How did you have that at such a young age?
You know, honestly, Gordon, I look back and I'm more terrified now, you know, when I look back and I think 26, 25, 24, I was designing cars, but 26, I was running the team when he made me technical director. And I should have been terrified, but I wasn't. So all I can think of is, and I don't know this is right, but all I can think of is that I must have had a massive amount of confidence and self-belief in those days. And as I said, I was much more bolshy in those days. I was probably a bit sort of forceful.
But then the results began to
reinforce
your thoughts.
Yeah, the first car, the BD42, the first race, it led.
Yes. Well, were you surprised that Bernie gave you so much freedom? I mean, you say that Chapman was an autocrat. I mean, Bernie wasn't. You know, he wasn't known for taking other people's opinions on board, was he? I mean, he himself was a bit of an autocrat.
Yeah, but Bernie's very shrewd. Bernie's a very, very clever guy. And what happened was, when he bought the team, we had a real, and this is why I think he got rid of the design team, we had a real melange of cars. We had a BT37, which was Ralph Bellamy's last car, which was a bit of a sort of a bitzer. We were running a BT 34, The Lobster Claw, and I think, or a couple of 40, we had a real mess anyway. So every race we had different cars, different amounts of spares. We had Graham Hill driving for us, and the one thing Bernie doesn't abide is not winning. You know, whatever he does, he wants to win. And we had a terrible season in 72. I think we got 8 points or something, you know. And Bernie came to me and said, right, I had enough of this. It was driven by that rather than by me. It was driven by the failure, and that was the important thing. He came to me and he said, I got rid of the other guys. You're it. I don't want to use one part of the old cars. I want a completely brand new Grand Prix car for the 73 season, and we're starting again. And that was the driver. And if you think about it, that's Bernie perfectly. And he knew to get the best out of me, he should let me get on with it.
A year later, the BT44, it nearly won its first race, didn't it?
Yeah, that led its first race too.
Yeah.
It was leading by 35 seconds and it ran out of fuel on the last lap. Yeah.
It's going to sound slightly odd question, but do you get the same kick out of winning that you see in the most competitive racing drivers, such as that kind of rage to win that we hear
Absolutely.
About? Did you feel that?
Absolutely, right. Yeah. I've never been interested in second or third in anything. And I don't just mean racing. I just...
Right.
I mean, it's like when I
don't play cards with
No, I'm very competitive. I am extremely competitive and have been all my life.
Yeah, okay. We're going to have to dive into the questions. There are so many. And actually, the Brabham era is clearly a very important one. The first three aren't actually questions, but there are thanks. We have from a Mercurius, Oscar, Matsarath, and Leone. I don't have a question, but it would be nice if you could say thank you to Gordon Murray for the BT52. That's it.
Well, that's very nice.
And another chap says, Oscar says, me too. The BT52B is surely the most glorious looking machine ever made anywhere, ever.
Good grief.
So more than Spitfire, Concorde, I mean, you know, Strat. That's but what we'll do is we'll go into... This is a good one from Alex Bremer. In this age of CAD, do you still see value in starting a car design with a pencil?
Well, that's a really good one because I do. In my office, I have a 2.2-metre drawing board and I still use the old 2-millimetre lead Pentel clutch pens, okay. Pencils and pens that I used to use in the 60s. And I love drawing.
Yeah.
For a few reasons. That's a very good question, actually, because firstly, I love drawing, and I've got 60 people next door that are very good at CAD, so we're learning CAD at this stage. It's not an option. But more importantly, for concept design, CAD is useless. It's completely useless, because CAD does straight lines and circles and joins the dots, and you cannot do a concept for a car on CAD. We never employ anybody that can't sketch. Mm. Whether they're 60 or whether they're 20, everybody should be able to sketch. Because you start, I start with just really just putting the major masses in the right place and then working a concept around that long before a shape of a vehicle takes place.
Yeah.
It's just working on the major masses and shifting around. And pencil and paper is a really good way of doing that. I mean, a good example was the Ox, the truck.
Yeah.
That was 2 weeks' work on a drawing board. And if you look at my concept sketches and the truck, there's almost no difference.
One and the same, yeah. I'm going to try and link the drawing board to the early Brabhams. They're very triangulated shapes on the early cars. They don't necessarily suggest a freehand drawing style. What was the...
Yeah, that's, again, quite a good question. But I think if you look at the BT42 and 44 bodywork, it is very swoopy.
Yeah.
And I had a favourite French curve, which I called the whale. I think it was number six or number nine, I can't remember. And virtually every Brabham was drawn with that French curve.
With the number six.
Yeah, it's a parabolic curve.
Yeah.
And the triangle was for a completely different reason. The triangle was to aerodynamic primarily, but also to lower the center of gravity of the car and to match up the DFE head angle with the main load pass to take a lot of weight out of the rear of the chassis.
Okay.
So that was a necessity rather than an aesthetic reason.
Simon,
now
if
I'm
I can,
going to go God. Through all the Brabham designs looking for that number six curve.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Did you use it on the F1 as well? The
McLaren F1? Yeah, I did.
You did?
Yeah.
Okay. There is a question here about the... let's have a look. Well, the fan car is... I honestly think that if we asked our readers to pick their single favourite Formula One car, it probably would be the fan car. And it's,
yeah, I need to do a book on it one day, I think.
What is... I mean... I sense odd to ask you, what is it about the fan car that has so captured the imagination?
I think it's the fact that it's so wild and so sort of in its own time, in 70s, sort of sci-fi.
Yeah.
Which was unusual in racing. I mean, you had big steps forward like the first monocoque and stuff, but the car still looked the same. You had, the 49 first car to use the engine structurally, but the car looked the same. Mm-hmm. I think the fan car was so dramatically different visually. And then coupled with that, it's the fact it went on to win its first race.
Yeah.
It's a bit
yeah.
like the F1 yeah. winning Le Mans. The yeah. F1 would be well known now, I'm sure. Well, I hope it would be. But it's even more well known because it won Le Mans. And yeah. I think the fan car, the fact it went and blitzed Lotus,
yeah.
who had the wing ground effect and sliding skirts.
Yeah. I wonder if the legend would be the same if it continued, if the car had its 2 or 3 years, or whether part of its legend is...
I tell you what, the following year, they would have had to ban them anyway. Because really? I had a BT47 fan car already on the drawing board with twin fans with variable pitch blades, and we would have pulled, massive G-force.
Yeah. Would the tyres have coped with that?
No, they would have. We had to run higher tire pressures on the fan car, and they would have had to change the sidewall construction.
Right.
Yeah.
We have a question, and I can't find it now, but I know what the question was. It was, what was the level of downforce that was created when the fan car was at idle, when it was just sat there?
What? The difference, that's, again, a very good question. The difference between the fan car and a normal car with conventional wings, or the Lotus, which was called wing cars, where the actual side pods were the wing and sealed with sliding skirts, those cars, the downforce you generate, it's like drag, goes up with the square of the speed.
Yeah.
So in hairpin corners, you're producing virtually nothing. And in those days, probably in a second or third gear corner, you were developing a few hundred pounds, and in a high-speed corner, probably around, I don't know, a ton, 1,500 pounds or something like that, of downforce. The difference with the fan car, because the suction and the downforce wasn't speed-dependent at all, it was engine-dependent. So we could produce maximum downforce standing still, which meant you could get a 2G start. And we had titanium drive shafts.
2G start.
Yeah. Yeah, because it was producing more than its own weight and downforce. So you could stick it on the ceiling with the engine at 12,000 revs and it wouldn't fall off.
Did you try that?
I'm glad you
asked. Would have been a great stunt. Funny enough, whenever I do a lecture now, I put the fan car slide in the wrong way around, upside down, and people think it's a mistake. That's a...
So does that mean that the drivers would have to learn the technique of balancing engine revs and suction?
I tell you what, it took a lot of explaining. Nicky got it relatively quickly. We were testing at Brands Hatch. And I had to say to the drivers, you have to choose gear ratios, forget the normal power out on torque band, every normally aspirated racing engine. You select the right gear going into the corner, so just after the apex, you're right in the middle of the torque curve, and then you start getting the maximum amount of push out of the corner. So the ratio is slightly longer than you would expect, and that's every racing car that's ever been made. That's what you have to do. And you build up out of the corner up to maximum power revs and change to the next gear. With the fan car, you were 1 or 1.5 ratios lower. So you went into the corner already at maximum revs before you even aimed at the apex. So you braked and changed down and you were at 12,000 revs already. Then you feathered the throttle round the corner and then changed gear once you were out of the corner.
To maintain the grip
and
level.
And then you had maximum downforce. And I tried to explain to the drivers that it took a lot of getting used to. But when Nicky got it, he was you know, it was like a revelation. It was like, now I see what you mean. But that came with a big danger, because they had so much more downforce than a conventional car. If you arrived at a corner, we were cornering, like Paddock Bend, we worked out, we were probably 25 miles an hour quicker than a conventional car going into the corner.
25
miles an hour. And if the driver arrived at the corner and the skirts were damaged and he didn't have suction, he would just fly off the road. So we went out to an aircraft breaker's yard and bought an altimeter, two altimeters. And that's why the fan car has a pitot tube on the front. The pitot tube is static pressure, obviously, and that goes to one side of the altimeter. And then we had another, the other side of the altimeter, because an altimeter just measures pressure differential to give you altitude, goes to the underside of the car. And we had a green zone and a red zone. And I said to the drivers when it started Sweden, forget the numbers on the altimeter. If you're flying into a corner, make sure the needle's in the green. If it's in the red, back off, because you've broken a skirt. And Nicky said he drove the whole race staring at the altimeter. Forgot the rev counter. He's just staring at the altimeter every time he went into a corner.
That has to be the only F1 car with an altimeter.
Yes.
Yeah. Interesting to compare that with your thoughts earlier on about Bernie giving you complete trust. Nicky must have placed the same complete trust in you to know that this was going to work, because if it didn't, obviously it was catastrophic for him. So...
yeah.
What was it about his makeup, or maybe how did you give him the confidence?
I think it was beyond Nicky. I think the drivers, I think you have to build up that. Okay. If you have a reputation for the cars failing or breaking, as Lotus did. It's very difficult to get driver confidence. But Brabham, the cars were, by and large, very solid and very reliable. I did all the stress calculations myself. And the cars were light, but they were safe.
Yeah.
And no matter who the driver was, you need to do that to build up the confidence. Having said that, to jump into the fan car and drive it completely differently with that much downforce must have taken a lot of courage.
Shades of learning to deal with a blown diffuser later on. Some people could, some people couldn't.
Yep, exactly. Yeah.
What was the process whereby Brabham eventually voluntarily decided to withdraw the fan car?
Oh, that was
just because you thought it was going to be banned sooner or later?
No, that was all political. So dear old Chunky Chapman could see his championship disappearing with Andretti, because they had mastered, well, I don't know if they mastered it, but they had discovered the wing car and had, you know, massively more downforce than a conventional wing car, and they were going to win the championship easily. And then the fan car came along, and it was pretty obvious to Chapman that every race we won, we were only halfway through the season, so every race we won, we would have won. Every race we finished, I beg your pardon, we would have won. So he was absolutely trying to whip up a storm in Sweden. He told Andretti to go around to the other drivers and say the car was chucking stones out the back. The fan efflux was only 55 miles an hour. And, of course, the fan chucks things centrifugally, not rearwards, so it was incapable of throwing stones. But he went round whipping up the story. That didn't work. And then they came along after the race and they sealed the car with a lead seal, and they sealed the authorities, they sealed the truck, made us put the car on the truck and sealed it. And they came around afterwards with an anemometer, and they measured more than I'd calculated, actually. I calculated 55% of the air for cooling and 45% for suction. And they got 60%, nearly, I think 58, 59, I got the letter somewhere, for cooling and the rest for suction. And wrote me a letter and said that we can run the car till the end of the season. But then they would change Article 3.7 and we couldn't run it the next year. So I said to Bernie, fantastic, that's the championship, done and dusted. But then Chapman got Tyrrell and a couple of the other constructors, got them all together. And they wrote Bernie a letter and they said, if you continue to run the car, that's the end of the Constructors Association. And Bernie was just gaining traction. And he could see that disappearing. So Bernie came to me and said, what do you think about what Trent? I said, I know what I think. I want to win the championship. But eventually, you know, he talked me into it and we withdrew the car. So we chucked away the championship, but Bernie went on to do good stuff. So,
yeah. In a way, that's one of the things that makes the fan car so special. There was sort of there's a rather grand gesture about saying we're yes. way ahead, but we're going to step back and let the rest of you fight it out.
And you had so many books and magazines that it got banned. You know,
yes.
And it didn't get banned.
No, yeah.
Withdrawn. Okay, I have to thank John Smith for the question on the downforce numbers for the fan car on static. So thanks to John for that one. The last question on the fan car from me: if you had the opportunity to brief Alfa Romeo or Ford or any engine supplier for a fan car, what would the spec be? Because you took an engine off the shelf, and am I right in saying that part of the reason the fan car existed was because of the layout of the Alfa Romeo engine, mm-hmm. hadn't it? But if you were to do a BMW, you know, to go to the BMW as you did with the F1 and say, right, I need this engine, what would have been your perfect spec for a fan car engine?
Well, actually, with the fan car, the shape and size of the engine makes no difference at all.
Okay.
Because you've got peripheral skirts. The BT47, the next generation fan car, was a big square box, more like a chaparral.
Yeah.
So we had more underfloor area and, as I said, twin fans and variable pitch blades, so we didn't use the horsepower down the straight. You could feather the fans on the straight.
Yeah.
It's not the shape, but what you would do is run completely different valve timing. So your camshafts would be completely different in a fan car engine.
Right.
So instead of aiming for maximum torque and balancing that with the power, because that's all compression ratio and brake mean effective pressure and camshaft timing, what you would do is make sure that there was a much wider band of torque higher up the rev range.
Right.
So make the engine much more peaky.
Right.
So forget about the low speed torque altogether.
Yeah.
And redo the cam so that the power, you had a wider range so the driver could accelerate more during the corner and still have the downforce.
Yeah. I was just trying to think whether that would be a two-stroke. Very light.
Yeah, could be.
But
I looked at the two-stroke ones.
Tell us more.
Well, in the old days, I looked at a gas turbine as well.
Okay, for F1?
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I flew across to Van Dorn.
Yeah,
but in those days we needed a CVT for a turbine because you had to run it between 100 and 105% all the time.
Mm. And Van Doren was the firm who produced the DAF.
That's right. But at the time, because they had a steel belt,
right,
which had steel rollers, which took the end force, and I thought, great. So I went across, flew across, and had a look at it. But they couldn't do more than 150 horsepower at that time, so I abandoned the turbine.
Right.
It was a very light engine. It had 600 and something shaft horsepower.
Right.
So I abandoned that. But then I worked with a chap, trying to remember his name, begins with E. Ertl, maybe? Anyway, two-stroke champion. And we looked...
Harold Ertl.
I think
Harold
was.
Ertl. Yeah, sidecar chap.
Oh, no, it wasn't him. No, it was a two-stroke chap. Two-stroke expert.
Yeah.
And we looked at doing a flat 12 with three four-cylinder engines joined together, two-stroke. The fuel consumption was dreadful, but the power was fantastic. But when we looked at the size of tanks we'd have to have, it was marginal whether we could get enough fuel in the car, so we didn't.
Would all the power have been between about 12.5 and 12.8 or something?
Yeah, in those days. On carburetors, absolutely, yes.
But can you imagine the sound?
Oh, yeah.
A 12-cylinder two-stroke. Oh, the mind boggles. Okay, I keep saying I'm going to go into the questions. I am going to go into the questions now. We're getting distracted. This is from a chap who's just given his name as B. How do I put a deposit down for your new supercar?
Well, we've had lots of letters about that. We are, to be polite, we're collecting and collating those letters in the order that we receive them.
Yep.
But I did say at the time when we announced the car that this time I would put myself under no time pressure whatsoever. Yep. I've spent my whole life up against deadlines, and I think it's about time we did something at our speed and when we have the right resource in place and the right team in place. And we've only just announced the building. The building needs kitting out. We'll kit that out next year, and then we'll have a look at it. So we have no time scale, so we're way off collecting deposits. But we are, to be polite and to be correct, we are collecting and collating the names and answering people who have written in.
Okay. How do you divide your time? I mean, if you were to apply a percentage of your time that, you know, is divided up into various projects, how would you split that up at the moment?
Unfortunately, I would say it's in GMD, even though I have a very good team of people running the business, I have an operational board with six members who run the business. I've sort of moved sideways to chairman now, but even so, that was to free myself up to do more design. I would say I'm probably two-thirds business, one-third design. Okay. And my goal in the next 3 years is to reverse that.
Okay, yeah.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here we go. Okay, as I say, we are going to jump around like crazy now. Should active ride suspension be brought back into F1? A question from @StrikeEngine.
No, active ride suspension. Absolutely not. I think anything that complicates the cars even further and has reliability issues and takes away driver input, let's say, from the performance envelope point of view, I don't like. I'd like to see Formula One getting back to being more of a driver's championship.
Okay. What do the drivers need from their vehicle to make it a driver's championship then?
They need no interference from the pits.
Okay, so no radio,
no
information from the car to the pits?
No, nothing.
Okay.
Nothing. That's absolutely top of the list, which would get rid of probably a quarter of the budget as well. I mean, these days, you know, the gear changes are all selected on a simulator before they leave for the circuit. You've got a massive team of people back, not only at the circuit, but back at base, making decisions all the way through the race. And the driver still has to have a lot of natural ability, but it's a bit point and squirt.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like that.
Do you think the cars are quick enough?
Yeah, I think from a speed point of view, they're quick enough. They don't sound good enough, in my humble opinion, but they're quick enough.
Do you think the speed element is important? And I ask that because, as an example, this year, pole position at the Circuit of the Americas, Formula One, Lewis Hamilton was at 1 minute 33.8, I think, something like that. MotoGP, same circuit, Marc Marquez, I think pole was at 2 minute 2 point something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's about a 30-second difference, same at Silverstone. And I know which is more dramatic to watch. Well, it's not the faster one.
Yeah, but that's my point. Speed is actually irrelevant. Formula One only needs to be quick enough so that it is still the quickest formula of that sort of off-circuit racing. Mm. That's it. It's perceived speed that's important for the public that are watching. If you look at a 1960s race for the 1.5 litre formula with the little V8s, if you look at a bit of film of that formula, I mean, those cars had very little horsepower, 180 horsepower. They look so quick because they're drifting and sliding, and you can see the driver fighting.
And there's no runoff area.
Relative to a car that's probably going 50% quicker around the corner, but on rails. And the perceived speed, you'd always choose the 1960s car. And I had a lot of people, getting back to the exhibition, we had a little film running in each section. And the 1970s film, I had a lot of people standing around me going, oh, look at that, people drifting and sliding and correcting. So it's perceived speed. The actual numbers aren't that important.
Mm. that's what makes the heroes in the sport as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think you can imagine a youngster watching Formula One today, the car accelerating, braking, turning, and him thinking, well, that's mathematical, maybe I can do that.
Yep.
You ask the same person to watch one of the top drivers at Goodwood in a lightweight E-type in the wet, and you're thinking, could never do that.
I was watching some vintage sidecars at Cadwell a few weeks ago, and I could probably corner some places more quickly on my push bike, but they look, you know, the poor old passengers somewhere several feet off the ground, and the things flexing and twisting, and as a spectacle, the drama,
absolutely
fantastic.
Yep.
Even though the cornering speeds are minuscule.
And the same goes for the noise. People expect racing cars to be noisy.
You need to be slightly scared, I think, when you stand next to a Formula One car and starts up.
Absolutely.
Or scared watching the vintage sidecars.
Well, I bet you were, yeah.
How important is the idea of a championship? Jenks used to argue that it should just be a series of races and you only campaign for one race at a time.
I think from a public perception, they love champions, don't they? And they love to champion champions. They like following people. And, you know, I think we've forgotten that Formula One was started primarily as a drivers' championship, and the constructors sort of came along as a secondary cup. And now the emphasis is so much on aerodynamics and the engine. I mean, every decade since 1950, since we started having World Championship Grand Prix races, there's been five elements you need to win a race and a championship. And the emphasis changes every decade. And the current emphasis is far, far too much for me on engine and aerodynamics.
Okay. René Klaus and Alex Wakefield. René Klaus asks, do you still own that Jimi Hendrix t-shirt I saw you wearing some 35 years ago?
I do. That's one of the 980, evidently.
He then goes on to say, have you ever been approached by Ferrari to become their chief designer? And Alex adds to that, what driver did you want to work with but you didn't have the opportunity to?
Answer to the first question is yes. Mm-hmm. And second question, it depends whether you're talking about drivers in my time or just drivers. I would have loved to work with Jimmy Clark. I just would have given anything to work with Jimmy Clark.
Because he was your hero or because there was something in the way he drove?
No, because it's the way he drove.
Okay.
You could put, when you see somebody that jumps out of a saloon car into a Formula 3 car, into a Formula 2 car, into a Formula 1 car, and then an Indianapolis car or a Galaxy, Lotus Cortina, and can handle that engine characteristic and that chassis characteristic, vehicle dynamics characteristic, wow, I would have liked to work with somebody like that.
Yeah.
Of your era.
Yeah.
Just trying to think. I would have liked to work with Jackie Stewart, who I only overlapped with 1 year, I think, 1 or 2 years in the beginning. But I would have loved to work with Jackie. I used to sit in 73, used to sit 73, 74, sit with Jackie and talk about how he focused on the first lap. I mean, the guy on the first lap, he was amazing. He used to come around a second and a half in the lead.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you do that?
Yeah.
You
know? Drivers are still only figuring out today that you need to do that.
Yes.
Get it at the start, and then that's
Jackie would have been fun.
Okay.
Can I flip back to the Ferrari question?
Yeah,
when were you approached?
You know, I can't. I think it might have been more than, it was always indirect, a bit like the Lotus offers. I think it might have been more than once, but it was probably 70s, I think, yeah. And then later sometime. But I got lots of offers from lots of people. Yeah. You had to be very careful working for Bernie, that you didn't accept these offers because, you know, you didn't know what was going to happen.
Yeah. Okay. The McLaren era now. So another question from this chap who's labelled himself as B-. Did you work on any F1 cars for McLaren during the Adrian Newey era?
No.
There was no crossover there?
No. Adrian joined a few years after I stopped, actually.
Okay. Yeah. From Andreas, I read conflicting accounts of whether you or Steve Nichols are responsible for the McLaren MP4-4. What really happened?
That old. Oh, dear. I tell you what. There's so much rubbish being written about Steve Nichols and the MP44. I joined McLaren as technical director, I said to Ron, I was going to stop. I think it's well known I was going to stop at 17 years at Bradman, and I thought that was enough. And I wanted a new challenge. But Ron was very persuasive, Ron Dennis. He just lost John Barnard to Ferrari. And I said to Ron, said, oh, you can come and you can do this and you can do that. I said, if I come, I'm coming as technical director. I don't just want to be in charge of design. I want to be in charge of anything technical in the company. For example, building up the composite shop, new autoclaves, redesigning the test team, building new test rigs, torsional test rigs, redesigning completely the way the team ran, lifing systems, everything. And I wouldn't have gone, you know. And it's quite ludicrous, really. I had so many cars to design at. We were doing a mule car to test the little V6, a Honda 1.5. The MP43 was already finished when I arrived. I arrived in October 1986, I think it was, 86, yeah. And that car, and that had been designed by a group of people led by Steve Nichols, but actually it was just an update of Barnard's last motor car. And so I had nothing to do with that at all. We did take one and stuff the 1.5 V6 in the back as a test mule. But then I had, in the next 3 years, we had to do a brand new car for the V6, the MP44. Then a year later, we had to do a car for the normally aspirated engine as well. And we had to do a test mule with the MP44 to run the normally aspirated engine. So I had four cars in the 3 years. And I had to pick, therefore, I had to pick, for the first time in my life, I had chief designers, you know, I had people that could lead the program. I always had to do everything myself, or me and David North. Mm-hmm. I never had this many people. I think we had about 10 people in the design office. It's a massive team for me after Brabham. And so I picked Neil Oatley to work on the NA program and Steve to work on the turbo program.
Right.
But I was in charge of every single element of the design. I let the team get on with the stuff I wasn't changing. So things like the monocoque and the bodywork and stuff, you know, we had a very good guy on aero. That I let the team just get on with. But all the new stuff, the biggest change in the car was the engine package and the gearbox and the back end and the aero around the rear diffuser. And the front suspension, which was my pull rod and roller that I'd first used in the Brabham Alpha BD48, as opposed to the McLaren system. So, yeah, I mean, why, if you think about it, I mean, there's so much rubbish being written about this, but why would I arrive from Brabham with two world championships, take a three-year break from car design, and then go and do the McLaren F1? Mm. You know, it's ludicrous, the whole thing that I didn't design cars when I was at McLaren. I think there was some sort of, I think the problem was there was a lot of bad feeling when I joined McLaren because they thought they could do it. And I think Steve was probably very put out that there was going to be another technical director because he just got rid of John. And John designed some very good cars.
Yep. Okay. The F1, we'll segue into that. John Saviano has asked, if you're asked to do the McLaren F1 over again, what would you do differently? I'm going to add something to that. When we did a story, when I was at Evo and we did a story with you on the F1, the intro to the feature was a picture of you pointing, I think,
oh, a little bracket. Oh, God, yeah. That still drives me mad whenever I see a car, yeah. That's absolutely true. That's, apart from upgrading to modern technology, which I'll come back to, that's absolutely true because I signed off every, I was fanatical about signing off every single drawing because obviously I didn't draw the whole car myself. I had a team of six people drawing bits. But I signed off every single drawing. And the car had already been signed off and we handed it over to production engineers. Yeah. And there was a final test at Bruntingthorpe, a high-speed run. And they noticed that the engine bay light kept flickering on and off. And what it was, we had a beautiful machined aluminium bracket with a micro switch that when you opened the engine cover, put the engine bay light on. And the suction over the top of the car at 130, 140 miles an hour was bowing that slightly and the light was coming on. and somebody decided that they would make a, I hate brackets anyway. I really hate brackets. Even now, I walk around and go, you know, don't make that bit do the work. Don't add a bracket to it to do the work. And somebody had made a steel, I mean steel for a start, bracket, and bolted it to this beautiful bit of, to extend the micro switch so it didn't come
brave
on.
Brave person.
And I didn't see it until the car went into production. So every single McLaren F1 has that bracket on it, and it's just dreadful.
I'm surprised you don't go around just unscrewing them.
Well,
you see
I
one,
did
you know.
Think, I was so incensed, I did actually think about redesigning it and posting every person a bracket. In fact, one owner made one for me and came and presented it to me.
Did he?
Made a new bracket, oh. All machined out of aluminium, and I've still got it somewhere.
Yeah. Okay. F1, a question again from Michael G. The F1 had fan-assisted aero. Did this work like the BT46B, and how strong was the effect in this application? I'm curious because you never see fan cars on the road.
Yeah, no, it wasn't at all like the 46B. What it was we had, doing a diffuser, the F1 was the first ground effect road car, which is you encourage the air under the front rather than trying to exclude it like the spoiler or skirt. And then you have a flat bottom, and then you have a diffuser which expands the air, and you encourage the air to speed up, and you have, in the Venturi area, you have low pressure, and you get ground effect. And it was the first car to use that. The problem is, with a road car, the lower wishbones are right in the way of where the diffuser wants to be, so you can't have a nice big diffuser, and you have to be quite gradual. So the ground effect is actually not that effective on most road cars. So what we did was we had fans on the car anyway for cooling the engine bay, electric fans, and for cooling the DC-DC converter for the electric screen. So I sucked the air for those fans from the front part of the diffuser. So the diffuser, instead of being gradual, takes a huge step. Hmm. And you remove the boundary layer and you encourage the air to stick to the diffuser, so you can get much more dramatic, which gives you more downforce.
Yeah.
So what happens is the fans are controlled by several things. If the DC-DC converter gets too hot, they come on. If the engine bay goes above 60 degrees centigrade, they come on. And if the car does more than 60 miles an hour, they go on. And the effect is noticeable, but not huge like the fan car, but it's rarely noticeable. So it's something probably in the order of 10-15% more downforce
right
over a standard diffuser.
Did the race car keep the fans? Was it allowed to?
No.
Right, okay.
No, we had to get rid of
stick
those.
Wings on it.
Because it was a movable aerodynamic device.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't think initially there was any plan, was there, for the F1 to go racing?
Not at all.
No. But when the racing version was adapted, I mean, how confident were you that it was going to perform well at Le Mans in 95?
Well, on the contrary, I was adamant when I sat down with Mansour Auger and Ron in the beginning, and I said, I'm a racing car designer. If you want me to do a road car, which is effectively a GT, it had to have luggage and air conditioning and sound system and stuff, please don't make me do a racing car because I'll compromise. And I wanted it to be an absolute no-compromise road car. So I was annoyed when we got bullied into doing it by Ray Belm for the 95 championship. I was annoyed that my decision had been overturned. I was worried because I thought, now, if I had known it was going to go racing, I probably would have had longer overhangs for aerodynamics, for example. And I was worried because, you know, racetrack, the loads on the car, we put a wing on it. And for a road car, the size of bolts and things that held the suspension on were absolutely the smallest they could possibly be. So I was worried as well. So I had all these mixed emotions. Having said that, when we went racing, I'd forgotten that subconsciously I am a racing car designer. And the thing was very stiff torsionally. Aerodynamically, it was good, had ground effect aerodynamics. It was very light, and the suspension geometry was pretty good, very almost no compromise in the suspension geometry, and the engine was stonking anyway, from a torque delivery point of view, in a power delivery. In fact, we had to detune it to go racing. It was that powerful. So it was a pleasant surprise, I suppose, but I was worried about it before we went racing.
There's a technical question. This is Peter from Canada. I suspect Peter is an engineer. Why does the static pressure increase in the middle of flat F1 floors? Why doesn't the pressure decrease from the leading edge of the floor to the diffuser inlet? Can separation occur at the leading edge of the floor? Why? Those cars hardly had any rake, did they not, in the 80s and the early 90s?
Okay. That's not a problem. When you have a flat floor, as opposed to going back to the Lotus wing car, which is a continuous wing shape, yes, with a very well-defined, or any of the wing cars in the 80s, 70s and 80s, had a very well-defined Venturi, where you had a lead-in to the Venturi and a long diffuser. So you squeezed the air against the ground, sped the air up, and got low pressure. That's how it works, basically. But with a flat floor car, it's much more difficult. And the question's absolutely, it's a good question, and he's right, because the lead-in, when you have air approaching a bluff object, which a car is, you have what we call a stagnation point. So you have a slice of air, an imaginary slice of air, and it feels the bluff form coming. And below that, all the air that wants to go from that slice wants to go under the car, and the air above it wants to go over the car. That's called the stagnation point. So with a ground effect car, the bit that's going under the car obviously is compressible at that speed, and it dives off towards the edge, the lower lip of the car. And if that's a sharp edge, like an air dam, lip sticking out, you have separation. And that separation never really recovers. Okay. So your flat bottom and your diffuser don't work very efficiently. So you'll find all the good ground effect cars with flat bottom have a curved front and a slight parabolic curve, coming back to the French curve again. And that encourages the air to stay attached. And what you get then is the air speeding up, and it gets squeezed, if you like, and sped up after its initial, if you imagine the slug of air below that separation point is maybe 300 mil high, now it's going to get squeezed to 100 mil, so it's speeding up. And that's your effective Venturi, even though it's a flat floor. And then you slow the air down again at the end into the base suction behind the car. But with a flat floor, you get boundary layer buildup, which makes, if you can imagine a wedge of dead air starting on the surface of the underbody of the car, and that wedge gets bigger and bigger and bigger, which completely destroys the area where you want the low pressure to be. So then you run rake.
Right.
So every flat bottom car has to run rake, and that cancels the wedge of boundary layer.
Yeah.
So you can determine by the rake of the car where your low pressure area is going to be, to a certain extent.
Nowadays, aerodynamics would be taught as a completely separate subject. Where did you pick yours up?
I just always have been fascinated in aerodynamics. I loved Second World War aeroplanes, and I've loved the development of aeroplanes and the supermarine high-speed planes from the 30s. That's where I got the surface cooling idea from, with the supermarine planes. And I've always just loved aerodynamics. I've been fascinated with it. So we used to experiment a lot. The BT-44 in 1974 had a crude form of ground effect with a sacrificial V underneath it. And I tested it with a water manometer at Kyle Army and found we producing 100 pounds of downforce under the car.
Designed. That was your intention from the start. Right, okay.
Yep.
Okay. Speaking of aerodynamics, I'm going to mention the word halo, because Anthony Jenkins, our reader, has suggested, gorgeous aesthetics have always been a trademark of your F1 creations. What do you think of the halo? What do you think the halo will do for F1 aesthetics in 2018?
Oh, I mean,
put a fan on.
Don't get me going on modern F1 aesthetics. I mean, they're completely driven by detailed design. For me, the cars have a technical beauty, but there's no proportion with the Formula One car, and all the little bits and pieces that stick up off the main surface, it's a bit like you've got a racing car that could look quite good, and then you camouflage it with lots of bits sticking out all over the place. So the halo is just another one of those.
It's a rather inelegant solution, as well. Surely, if you or some of the top guys involved in Formula One were asked to deliver a halo, the car has to have a halo, the driver needs a halo. So come up with your ideas. Yeah. You wouldn't put a flip flop on the cockpit, would you?
I certainly wouldn't. No.
Right. Okay. We are coming towards the end. I'm afraid, and I'm hoping that I've got through a lot of the questions. We have answered many of the questions in here. I'm going to go back to Le Mans McLaren. Renato Guarda, would you like to design another car for Le Mans? Would you prefer? If so, would you prefer a GT or a prototype?
I love Le Mans. Actually, I've only I first went to Le Mans '72, and I designed the 3-liter prototype for Alain de Cadenet, Chris Crafter drive.
Yeah.
And then I didn't go back until 95, but only because I was 95, yeah, with the F1, only because I was massively busy, firstly with Formula One, and then secondly setting up McLaren and designing the F1. I love GT racing and Le Mans. I think I'd love to go back and do some racing again, a sports car racing, and I'm hoping we can one day, but I'm not sure about the direction the prototypes are going. I actually worked very closely with the ACO for 6 years, some time ago, to try and get back to the top class being more road car based,
okay,
and away from prototypes or such extreme prototypes.
Yeah, yeah.
Where it was like a two division race, if you like, because I thought that was the root of Le Mans. And although there's certain groups of people who expect extreme prototypes, not as extreme as we've got now. I mean, they're basically closed in Formula One cars.
Yeah.
And hugely expensive to bring to the race.
Yeah.
And of course, the disaster there is you only need one or two people to stop, and your whole concept of the entry profile changes.
Yeah, as we've seen.
So I try to get them to do two things. I try to get them to bring GT cars back and have them much more important again, and to maybe restrict the prototype so they weren't that much quicker on downforce,
because
they're very slow on the straights. I think the F1 was quicker than this year's winning car on the straight.
Mm.
And the other thing I try to get them to do, from the point of view of developing new technology, rather than let the prototypes get carried away with that, which is massively expensive, and maybe in a direction that road cars couldn't follow, I suggested that maybe they bring back the index of performance, and you make that almost as important as winning the race. So in other words, for any given car, the total energy you use for the distance traveled, you could win a cup that was almost big as the winning cup, and start to make that important again. And I think that would drive people for not just engine technology, but more efficient motor cars.
Yeah.
You said you'd love to get back to some racing. Did you mean behind the wheel or behind a team?
Actually, both, because while I still can at this age, I had the good fortune, Charles March asked me to bring my T1, my first IGM Ford, the little racing car, to Goodwood, and I ran it up the hill at the Festival of Speed, and wow, that was pure nostalgia. I was 19 again. You know, the noise, the smell, the way the car handled, the steering feel, everything came back to me. And I thought, wow, it'd be fun to do some hill climbs or something with that. And then I've just built a recreation of the Brabham BT44B. I've just made one. And I'd love to drive that too, because I used to drive all the Formula One cars up until the BT48, and then we lost our tall drivers, and I made the monocoque 3 inches short, and I couldn't fit anymore. Stupidly, didn't think of that. So the last Grand Prix car I drove was the V12 BD48 Carl Army. Yeah.
Did you have it run in the Fanco?
No, shame, I didn't. No, but so I'd like to. Yeah, that would be fun.
How much of a fist did you make of driving an F1 car?
I mean, I didn't go high-speed testing, but I just drove them to see what they felt like. I wanted to see what carbon brakes felt like, for example, the feedback from the brake pedal. And I wouldn't have been anywhere near competitive on lap times, but it was good to drive all the cars and see the engine management and, you know, the power delivery and stuff like that.
I'd like to find out how the Rocket, the light car company Rocket, where does that sit in your list of favourites? I love the car, just the principle, the way yes. It looks. I wish there was a one-make series for it. I'd love to have seen.
There nearly was.
Was there?
There nearly was.
Oh, that's just
Chris Craft came within a gnat's of actually getting, with the blessing of Max Mosley, wow, and even Bernie, I think, from memory, of having a one-make series and supporting a few of the Grand Prix.
Oh, can you imagine?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, all different coloured motor cars buzzing around at 11,500 revs. I mean, it would have been fantastic.
Yeah.
I still love that car for two reasons. Because again, going back to Colin Chapman, but it miffed me that the Lotus 7, which later became the K-Trim, was still the world's lightest road car at 500 kilos. Really upset me. So I had a target of 350 kilos. Mm. But it was going to be a single-seater. Chris Craft, who was going to build the cars and funded it, wanted it to be a tandem two-seater. So we lost 20 kilos. So we were 370. But it's still, as far as I know, still the lightest road car out there. But the other thing I like about it is if anybody ever wants to know what lightweight does for vehicle dynamics, I just say get in the car and drive it, because you can't believe how it steers, turns in, and brakes. And you can four-wheel drift it. It's on road tires where the compound is much too hard for the weight of the car, which is fantastic on a high-speed circuit like Goodwood. You can four-wheel drift it all around the lap.
Yeah.
But there was a parallel side-by-side two-seater in
the
design
Lightning
as well.
The yes. Lightning, yes. Yeah.
And one of your ghost cars.
And happily, yeah. Chris had a chassis, because I said to Chris, it's going to look a bit empty. After the Rocket, I'm going to have the Lightning drawings up and stuff. And he said, I've got a chassis, you know, have the chassis. So we had the chassis there. We built the engine. We did a one-off with Russell Savory. We did a one-off V8, 2-litre V8 using two Yamaha FZR cylinder heads with our own crank, dry sump, fuel injected, 305 horsepower, 10,000. And the car was going to weigh 560 kilos. 300 horsepower. So that's one I do want to finish one day. Right. Definitely got to finish that.
Watch that space.
Okay. I think that's a great place to end it. Well, it's not actually. I'm sure we could talk forever. And especially now I'm thinking of bike engines with... Yeah, but yeah, let's not go there. I think I've just seen a vision of your next.
Maybe.
Maybe.
You might be closer than you think.
Okay.
I want to see him finish with a two-stroke V12. That's what I'm looking forward to hearing, certainly.
Yeah. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us on the Royal Automobile Club.
It's been fun.
Show. Yeah, we've really enjoyed it. Thank you very much to Gordon and to Simon as well from the
Motorsport team.
Thank you, guys. Yeah. Thanks to you for listening as well. We've had some amazing questions for this talk show. Please stay in touch with us on the website, motorsportmagazine.com. We've got some great talk shows coming up, and the questions have been magnificent. And thanks very much to Gordon to answering them in such detail. So we'll see you at the next Royal Automobile Club talk show. Thank you very much.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.